All right, if everybody's ready, I think we will gavel to order. It is my distinct privilege and pleasure to welcome everybody to the Flood Resilience Committee of the Town of Mount Pleasant. Today is Monday, August 31st, and I appreciate everybody being here. And our agenda is before you. Item number two is approval of the minutes from our August 4th meeting.
Move for approval.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Item three is public comments. If you are a member of the public and you have something you would like to say or to present, please come forward. You have 2 minutes. We need your name, address, blood type, shoe size, DNA sample. Just kidding. Name and address will do it. One of the things, we do have a letter. Eric, I sent you this morning. Thank y'all. I know y'all put it in. Should we include that as like a public comment or just put that with the second item on the agenda? Hillary, I don't know if it matters to y'all at all. There are some pictures, but maybe just do it with that.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll do it that way then. Okay. That's fine. All right, no one else for public comments? All right, it is our privilege to have with us today someone who I consider a friend, a leader in our state. You might have seen recently the end of the, how many mile hike was that, Tom?
500
miles hiking the seven wonders of South Carolina and doing a dive in the Cooper River. Tom Mulliken, he wears many hats, but the hat he is wearing today is as chairman of the South Carolina Floodwater Commission that was formed by the governor to address flooding in our state. What to do with it. Tom, if you would come forward. It's our privilege to have you here. I know you and Howard have served together in the State Guard of South Carolina, of which you were the commander, and it was my privilege to be at your change of command ceremony.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
So thank you all for carrying on in the actual unit, I guess, of Francis Marion, dating all the way back. So it's our privilege to have you here. Tom is going to give us some macro down to micro level information about what the committee's work or the commission's work was, and some ideas for us to carry forward in the town of Mount Pleasant. So without further ado, and Tom, you can remove the mask when you're speaking. I know it's a lot easier to do so.
Thank you. Got all this white
nice
hair
beard.
In my mouth.
Was that a bunker beard, or did you have that before? The
Santa Claus in the summertime.
Okay.
Hopefully that'll make everybody feel better. Let me first start off by saying what an honor it is to be with you here in Mount Pleasant, one of the most beautiful cities in the country and in the world, in my opinion. My sister-in-law lived here until she passed, and we always this was always vacation for us, so it's always fun to come down and be with you. So thank you, and it's an honor to appear. In 2018, the governor created this South Carolina Floodwater Commission to address the continuing floods that we had dealt with, beginning back in 2015 with Joaquin and moving forward. I don't know if I brought bad luck, but as commander of the State Guard, we had a severe flood every year. So I was hoping they'd be happy when I retired that maybe the floods would go away. But this is a global issue that's playing itself out and manifesting in local communities across our state. Here in South Carolina, it's fairly unique because we deal with three concurrent challenges. We deal with extreme weather coming off the ocean with hurricanes and coastal erosion and associated issues. We also deal, and we will be dealing with water coming from extreme weather coming up through the Gulf and dropping water into the North Carolina watershed, and those watersheds releasing their water into rivers that ultimately impact South Carolina. And then the third concurrent issue is nuisance flooding. And I know that's something that you deal here with in Mount Pleasant. So this is not something, an issue that's just being dealt with along the coast. It's something that's being dealt with all over our state. And during Joaquin, I know that you know we started with the river systems and the watersheds in the upstate, and we had dams breach, and then we had those dams, that water releasing, creating more dams breaching, and we really barely averted a Rita Katrina situation in Columbia. A lot of people don't realize how close we came. Howard, I know you remember, we were actually literally on the canal in Columbia putting rocks, as my boss, the adjutant general, said, we went from strategic to tactical. So that's the background. And it's a very difficult issue because it's largely been defined by sort of political extremes. We're dealing with what is causing these events and what can we do about it? And for years, the public really only had two options. You either had to ascribe and put arms and legs around a theory that what would be considered sort of Armageddon, that we're going to, that the world is going to come to an end. And I have people who I have dealt with for now almost 40 years that really believe that. And I lived through several iterations. I think probably the most serious was when we crossed 400 parts per million in carbon concentration, that we would see just horrific circumstances. Of course, we're over that now. And so you had that on one extreme, and then on the other extreme, you had people that were prepared to say the climate is not changing. And the truth is, the climate has changed throughout all of time. And where we are now is we're trying, we've gone through a period of what I would say would be decades of modeling to determine what would likely be the scenario, to where we're now measuring. And that's a very different place to be. Because we see it, we know it's happening, we know that flooding is occurring, and we have people all over the state. So if I tell you anything at all, it's that we started up at Oconee County, and this was part of the Floodwater Commission, to solicit public input, that we talked to thousands. And we did a video every day, and those videos were watched, and one video had 23,000 views. People are interested in this issue, and they want to know what they can do because they're being impacted by it. Now it's no longer sort of an esoteric, sort of political issue. It's happening and people are worried about it, particularly those people who've had their houses flooded out. So let me start at a macro level, because the political conversation really sort of, you deal with it at a macro level, which is what's going on globally, and then how it's playing out locally is at a micro level. At a macro level, we're dealing with the global climactic change. And as I said, climate has changed all of time. We've had vicissitudes of warming and cooling. But what causes that is typically referred to as the greenhouse effect. And I'm not going to talk a lot on this, but I think to give you some background may be good to give you some context. The greenhouse effect is simply, we have one atmosphere, and I won't spend a lot of time there, but that really should set optics on this. We have one atmosphere, and that atmosphere is a very thin blanket around Earth that allows the Earth to sort of regulate itself. And that blanket is made up of the gases that are emitted. And those gases are knitted together that form that blanket, the atmosphere. So in dealing with this thing at a global level, to know how to begin to positively impact it, it strikes me as a good place to start, is knowing what those greenhouse gases are. And I speak all over the world on this, and it's always fascinating to me about people that are so passionate about this issue that don't know what those gases are. So I'm going to start by saying that the six greenhouse gases, and there are more, we can talk about that, but the six that are looked at by the United Nations are carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and three synthetic gases, the fluoride gases, perfluorocarbon, hydrofluorocarbon, sulfur hexafluoride. And those gases remain as knitted into the atmosphere for different lengths of time, and that's where you'll hear it spoken about, global warming potential. For example, carbon dioxide is the baseline, and sulfur hexafluoride remains in the atmosphere about 12,500 times longer. So if you ask the person on the street, your constituents, that and many of them have read a lot on this issue, how much of those greenhouse gases emitted every year are emitted by humans? Most people would think, because it's what they read, that humans release all those gases. And the truth is that humans release very little of those gases. I've never seen that number, and I can refer you to different sites, but I've never seen what they would call anthropogenic interference get into double digits. The number that's typically agreed on is a little less than 6%. But what we're talking about is a careful balance. And so this idea is, are man's actions, is the anthropogenic interference the cause of climate change? I would encourage you to look at this issue by saying, to what degree have man's actions amplified global climactic change? Because you really can't sort out what are anthropogenic human releases from naturally occurring releases. And we could talk about some of that if you're interested. But it becomes important because we have a global issue. And this global issue has been terribly mishandled by the international community. Terribly mishandled. Now, I used to say that and people hoot me out of the room. But unfortunately for them, I've lived long enough to see what I said would happen, happen. And that is only briefly since 97 when the Kyoto Protocol, which is the underlying document, China's increase since the Kyoto Protocol is larger than our gross emissions. Their increase. And why is that important? We go back to 97, we see that what the Kyoto Protocol did is it divided the world up into two different sets of countries, developed nations and developing nations. And the developed nations, the US, EU, and others, it was going to create certain reduction criteria. For the developing nations, it was going to allow for voluntary reporting opportunities. And that wouldn't be all that significant if the developing nations were Ethiopia or Micronesia or Namibia. But it is important when you look at that list that's in the Kyoto Protocol, and it includes China, India, Brazil, top 10 emitters in the world. So what we've seen is a very fractured international agreement where what we do here, if we don't get our arms around it, to the extent that we believe that the anthropogenic interference can be retarded, you need everybody at the table. Okay, so that's globally. Then as we look at this, and what I would recommend is that we begin using a surgical instrument. We begin using a surgical instrument. So what does that mean? That means that at a state level, for example, our total anthropogenic interference is 69 million metric tons. And so then we need to look at where those emissions are coming from. And if you look at a pie chart, you'll see those emission sources. Now we know the gases. The sources are transportation, industry, energy, agriculture, commercial, and residential. But the three largest ones are energy, transportation, and industry. So how do we, and I say that only because at a state level, and even here, if the city doesn't have a sustainability study to understand what your footprint is, that may be something you might want to consider, because when you're talking to people on the street and this idea of climate change comes up or sea level rise or some of the associated issues, most people immediately go to the macro issue because that's what they've read about. And it's manifesting at a micro level. So what I could tell you is that South Carolina, as a result of a number of things, we'll take a global position of leadership. We're taking four coal plants off the grid. Those four coal plants will account for right at 13 million metric tons. That alone will have us have one of the largest, if not the largest, reductions of any governmental unit in the world. And so this really gets into this point, because I go back to where I started, which is to say you sort of had the Armageddon and the climate isn't changing sort of narratives. And that leads people to think that economic and environmental sustainability aren't the same thing or can't be the same thing. You sort of have to deal with, because the people saying the climate's not changing largely is because of the economic implications of change. So here we see we're taking those coal plants off. Now, why is that? Is it purely because of environmental? And if you dig deeper, you'll find that that's not the case. The case is that utility scale solar, which now is beginning to set the market different than natural gas, is now much less expensive. And we're looking at about a penny a megawatt versus 2.3 cents in that area for natural gas or over three for coal. You're seeing that the convergence of economic and environmental sustainability. So macro level. And what we're looking at now is, in this state, a huge opportunity because we have Volvo, we have BMW that are beginning to manufacture electric vehicles. We have a lot of conversation, multi-state, which things you'll be reading about, creation of a multi-state e-highway that allows for recharge stations, because you can't have an electric car if you can't refill. And so you see the state doing some things. So you look at the energy grid. The energy section of that source is going to come down. We're looking at now the ability to put energy generation for our large sort of energy intensive, and we're looking at transportation. And then we're beginning to see how that pie chart can begin to recede at a macro level. Now that's here. And as long as China continues to increase at the dramatic level, the total is not going to be reduced. But for us in this state, we're looking at it from two different ways. Macro, what can we do for a position of leadership? And we're seeing those things. At a micro level, this was like almost political heresy for years to say this. The sea level's rising. Like, I mean, and for years, if I said it, the half the room would just, you know, hoot me out. And that was at a time when we were doing more modeling. But now we're measuring. And this is something that's happening. And these numbers that are being presented to me is certainly on this last 500-mile hike, as people are reading a lot of sort of worst-case scenarios. And worst-case scenarios are very worst-case. And so it's not like dropping water in the deep end of a pool where it's going to be, everything's going to be okay because it's out there. When you're talking about marginal increases in sea level rise, we're talking about dramatic impacts along the coast. If you go back to macro level, 40% of the world's population lives within 60 miles of the coast. So when we start talking about sea level rise and the oceans moving in, the mayor and I went to high school not far from each other, and I tell people I live on beachfront property in Kershaw County because it was at one time. So what are we going to do? And I think what the governor said is we're going to create a scenario where we embrace the water. Why? Because that's what we have to do. That's what we have to do. We're not in a position by ourselves as municipalities or counties or state or even the federal government to address, to retard this without an international agreement. So what does that mean? I want to give you just a couple of other data points that may grab your attention, maybe some of your constituents. Two-thirds of the Earth has water on it. Of all the water on Earth, only 2.7% is fresh water. And of that 2.7%, only about 1% is available to us, because the rest is Antarctica and Greenland. And as some of that water would become available, then it becomes a sea level rise issue, right? Because we're having continental ice. We're losing parts of the ice shelf on both, and that's one of the contributing factors to sea level rise. So we have issues along the coast with saltwater intrusion, which is a long-term issue. We also have the fact that and I saw this on this trip, that because we have more rain, more extreme water, we have more sort of breeding grounds for mosquitoes. And that gets you into this whole epidemiological conversation about airborne pathogens. And that's what you see around the world where this is happening. So all this sort of shapes up to be a fairly scary conversation if you weren't from South Carolina. Because we've always embraced challenges here. And I am 100% confident that we can do something about it. So what can we do? There's a number of things that, and I want to start by offering some perspective that what I've seen a lot of years, and now being a professor both at Coastal and I teach every year down at the Galapagos on this subject, is that there's a lot of natural science available to us. And there seems to be, even among antagonists, a growing sense of consensus about what some of that science looks like. But what we don't have is a lot of consensus on the social science. There's still a lot of uncertainty and antagonism in the public. And I offer that only because I would not ever be a good mayor or a good council member because I just don't know that I would have the personality to deal with a lot of these varying perspectives. I get eaten alive all the time because I speak on this, but you're in a position where this issue is being thrust on you. And I think part of the difficulty with this issue, unlike a lot of the issues you may deal with, it's not static. It's not like if the state of South Carolina doesn't do anything on this issue this year, it's going to be the same issue next year, because it isn't. It's going to be harder next year because the sea level continues to rise. Right now, a little less than 4 millimeters a year. And there are triggering points where there's very legitimate science that would suggest that once you cross over certain thresholds, that could actually get worse. And there are people now talking about 6 to 9 feet of sea level rise by the year, and those years vary. The last I read coming down here was 2080. So what will be our legacy? I think one of the issues that will define our legacy is how we deal with this. But there are things that we could do, and what I would recommend, we've got a number of things that we recommended. This was the report. It's about 450 pages, and we've got a couple hundred more pages of comments that are also very good. So I'd be happy to make this report. It's available electronically, but I'll send hard copies down here if you'd like. I think the city of Mount Pleasant has a huge opportunity to be a local leader. So let's talk about some of the things that we recommended to the governor. And I'll say the first thing is, I went in because it's hard for people to digest this much science. And this is just the start. So we had to boil it down, and I wanted to give him 10 recommendations. So I go in, we met before COVID over the holiday season, Christmas, New Year's. So the first thing we want to do, Governor, is we want to plant 1 million trees over 10 years. And then I started talking, why trees? Well, one tree sinks 11,000 gallons of water over the course of one season, one year. So I think that's 30 to 40 gallons a day. So we wanted to start by doing the things and recommending the things that we knew we could get done. And I said, 1 million trees, I thought that was a pretty good goal. He said, I love that, Tomcat, but let's do that in one year. I said, well, I'm glad I didn't say 10 million. Mm-hmm. So 1 million trees. This year, we're set to have what we're calling Power Plant South Carolina, where we will plant 1 million trees on one day, and it'll be the single largest tree planting in the history of the country. And that's something that Mount Pleasant can do. It needs to begin to think about how do we build those things that we can do, that we can do. That's because where you're going to get pushback, I would imagine, I'm not an elected official, is when you start expending governmental resources. So people say, well, how much money did you spend on 1 million trees? So I'm going to tell you how we did it. We got the Forestry Commission to give us, it was about 12,000 saplings, but 8 million seeds. And I was like, oh, wow, okay, well, I got 8 million seeds. What am I going to do with that? Well, then I talked to the director of the Department of Corrections. And I said, rather than being work crews, do you think you'd have some volunteers who'd be willing to package seeds? So the female prisoners in two prisons in our state agreed to package, as part of their good time, 8 million seeds into 1 million packets. So we now have that. Then I was like, okay, well, now I got 1 million packets. What am I going to do with them? So I called the superintendent of education. I said, we have 823,000 public school children in the state. Can we turn this into a learning opportunity? And she was like, oh, man, I love that. Because we're not just planting a tree, we're planting an idea. We're beginning to have people understand some of the things that can be done. So we've arranged it with the Department of Education. We're now down at a local level and would love to have Mount Pleasant sort of leading the way. There are counties that have agreed that they want to be first up. Because then I don't want 20,000 packages strewn along the roadside. In Mount Pleasant, I want to make sure they're going in the ground, so we're working with counties and cities to say, getting private partners to pay for a sign, coming up with a property where we're going to plant these trees. These trees were planted by such and such elementary school, junior high school in this year, and we can watch these things grow together. So that's 11,000 gallons a year per tree once it's a mature tree. It also sinks 1 metric ton of carbon over the life of the tree. So what are we doing in South Carolina? Go back to that macro level. We are creating a 1 million metric ton carbon sink. So that's another million metric tons off of that. So we're going to plant 1 million trees, and I recommend you look at that. We're also going to, what we see is, and the people will tell you this isn't true, and they may be right in their local area. It is accurate where I've been. And that is, this is no knock on the federal government, but they quit cleaning and dredging and doing a lot of the work they had done in the past in our rivers and creeks and streams decades ago. And so I'm not sure here, and I told the mayor I don't want to comment on things I don't know, but I've done a lot of river cleanups, a lot of canal cleanups. Marion County, we cleaned 2.5 miles of canal. Howard, you were there. We had the governor, lieutenant governor, members of Congress, local elected officials, and about 300 volunteers. And what I could tell you is you cannot imagine what's coming out of these,
exactly,
these systems that allow for the natural flow. Mm. And so I'll only pause here for a moment to say, and I will not ever lose this sight, that we were cleaning in a canal, and the canal was right behind, directly behind a mobile home park, where people were pulling their water off a well. Mm. And out of that canal, I personally pulled virtually everything you can imagine floating out of your carport or garage during a flood is in that canal now. So in that canal, we had paint thinners, we had gas, we had radiator fluid. All these things, if they come out of an industry, they're labeled hazardous waste. These are bad guys, toxic waste. They're leaching directly, they're going directly into the canal, and they're leaching into our water systems. This is going on. Sort of an ancillary issue, but it's an important issue. And I deal with it a little bit in here about the epidemiology. And so we have the holding ponds of water, we have epidemiological impacts. But what we really start with is we don't have free-flowing water. We don't have free-flowing water. So I'm happy if there would be any value to come here and walk all your waterways. Because one way you can get the public's attention is to begin looking at those ways that you can create a natural flow. How do you get the water flowing back from the mountains to the sea? Right now, it's not. So we talked about cleaning rivers and canals, and we can't do enough of that. We're doing it all the time. We're doing it. We did it on this SC7, on this hike. And it's something that you can do to begin to build an awareness, because you can talk about that. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you get people talking about these issues that have been so hijacked by this vitriol that's defined them? One way is to get people active. Mm-hmm. People want to know what they can do. At least that's been my experience. We want a couple other areas. We have a huge footprint with our military. If we don't do things where our military installations can make it beyond high tide or make it beyond, we're going to lose assets. Probably one of the first institutions to really speak on this issue is the Department of Defense. And you see that for a lot of reasons. The Northern Passage, you see it because of training. And we're working closely with our military installations. We want a living shoreline. One of the first meetings we had, we planted sweetgrass in Charleston at the meeting. And what can we do to restore a living shoreline? I mean, that's an issue that's sort of center mass for the town of Mount Pleasant. We want to harden what happens during the storm is we lose power lines. So we're working with our investor-owned utilities, and we're creating a hardening of lines. There's some areas of the state you can't drill through granite and expect that to be a real resolution. There are other areas because it's so flooded that it won't work. But we're looking at that. We're also looking at distributed power. And South Carolina will benefit as we have more distributed power, because our lines are what come down during a storm, so distributed power. But here, what I would do is I would create a plan that has four or five key issues. And then I would have a continuum. And because I think we could agree on where you need to be. It's those incremental steps that become very problematic. And for governments who, for all the right reasons, want to go from A to Z, they're probably going to get a lot of resistance, because we need the public to be a part of this. So, you know, this is my own edification, and this is from Tom Mulliken only. There are people that debate market-based solutions versus government solutions. I'm probably getting ready to make everybody mad. I don't know if the media's in here, but I'm going to say this anyway. The truth is, we used to be able to talk about a balance. You know, one party was about smaller government, more market-based initiatives. The other party was about bigger government and government-based solutions. But there was always some contemplation, even if implicit, that there was a balance. This is an issue that needs both. And as I told you, the single biggest reason, and I'll let them speak for themselves, that we're moving away from one type of technology to another on our energy grid has as much or more to do about economics as it does environment. But it just so happens it's also going to reduce the environmental footprint of a state in a large way. So how do we create that appropriate balance? And I think technology is going to be a big piece of it. If we had an ability for desalinization, if we had the keys to that, to unlock that code, we'd be like Fiji. I finished a big project down in Fiji a couple of years ago, and they were kind of laughing about us buying all their Fiji water. I'm not sure it's coming out of, by the way. I don't know what, if it is or it, I don't know if they're turning on a spigot or getting it out of a, you know, a clear water source. But we, you know, one of the things we want to look at is desalinization. We need our best minds around that. We need MUSC. We need Charleston University. Is it still okay to call it the college? That's what my wife called it when she was there. We need to have our best minds around how do we create an environment where we can drive market-based solutions into that. And this state is famous for that. The single largest recycler in the country and one of the largest in the world started right here in South Carolina. And it started by recycling steel. Nucor Steel started, built their first, what they call a mini mill in Darlington, South Carolina. They did it because their CEO couldn't get the raw material out of the Northeast. So he said, well, I'm going to build it. And he couldn't get the raw materials. He said, well, I'll learn how to recycle scrap steel. And now I don't work for Nucor, but I think they recycle about 22 million tons a year. I have a suit on today, but ordinarily, if you saw me on the street, the khakis I'm wearing are made out of plastic. What can we do to find a way to drive market-based solutions into that? Because when people can become profitable off these things, they get a whole lot more interested about it. Mm-hmm. I think that it's worth a conversation to say, how can we unleash our entrepreneurial spirit on these things? But in the meantime, I think what we need is to build a consciousness and a level of support to address issues that are going to be legacy issues. And I would start by having four or five things that the city can do without a great deal of cost. What I've meant to come back to is a million trees cost the state nothing. Mm-hmm. Cost the state nothing because the Forestry Commission got the seeds donated. Okay, nothing. And it's just, it's trying to tune out the noise and do things demonstrably that will help. We can do river cleanups, canal cleanups. Do we need, is that going to get you into some development issue? Yeah. I mean, it probably is because impervious surfaces are creating greater challenges. I mean, this is not anything that's not intuitive when you think about it. We need somewhere for the water to go. So is the water coming? Yes. Is it going to continue to come? Yes. Do we need to embrace it? Yes. And when we do, we'll be establishing in this state, from the days of Francis Marion, has met the greatest challenges. This state's the reason why the United States serves as a beacon for democracy. Mm-hmm. And I know that working together between the state level and county and cities that we can create solutions. And I would simply add that I'm eager to help with that. So I'm happy to volunteer in any capacity.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to turn it over to the committee members for a few questions. We're supposed to go until 2:30. We got another agenda item, but we've got a good 10-15 minutes. I know I have some questions. So, Howard, I'll start with you down there if you have.
Well, first of all, General, thanks for being here and helping us.
Yes, sir.
As I said earlier, we miss you at the State Guard.
Miss you there. And
I've had the pleasure of working with you for several years when we were the State Guard together, and it was about flooding. It was about flooding that we worked in the storms. And I'm glad to hear you say that cleaning the water resources and making for free-flowing conditions is a major item that we should look at. I started working with our Public Services Department on one area in particular, and today it is free-flowing, and we cleaned up, with the help of the county, a lot of garbage, whether it was beer bottles, beer cans, soda cans, and, you know, lots of large bricks, as well as parts of trees. And that's a very key thing. But we need to have a crew that does nothing but clean our ditches, clean our smaller tributaries, if you will. And I've pledged to work on that from a budgetary standpoint. And then obviously we've got issues, much larger issues with drainage. So, and I know that's a pet issue of the mayor, and I'm on board with that. We need to do a better job. But thanks again for being here with us, and thanks for what you do for South Carolina.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
Kevin?
Well, thank you very much. That was incredible. I was really excited to hear all your ideas and even the background that you gave us, giving it from a very scientific viewpoint. And so a couple quick things. One is love the power plant day. I mean, what a great thing to call it that. I've mentioned in our last flood resilience committee meeting how excited I was when Scotland made the decision as a country to plant millions and millions of trees and get to a certain percentage, and basically how important that is for all the reasons you said, cleaning the carbon out of the air, as well as of course, addressing flooding. And I know I, for one, as a council member and as a private citizen, would be very excited to help us become a major part of planting those trees, those seeds. So definitely want to move ahead with that. I have on the river and marsh cleanups, a couple years back when we were looking at a plastics ordinance, I created a concept called Mount Pleasant Eco-Friendly Partners. I'd like to send it to you. We actually have incorporated some of this in a thing that ended up being called Mount Pleasant. What is it? Eco Partners? I think it's Eco Partners. They left out the friendly. I always like to think of things being friendly, especially in a town called Mount Pleasant. But anyway, and there were a number of things in here, including having businesses get essentially a credit towards their eco-friendly contribution to the community for doing things like having a once a quarter marsh cleanup day for some of their employees that are willing to volunteer, not forcing anybody. But so I'll send that to you and see if you think of anything that maybe we could actually start to promote.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Well, let me say on that we have found tremendous support in the corporate community. Yamaha has a nonprofit that's associated called Yamaha Right Waters. Mm-hmm. They sponsored part of SC7, and they're very interested in getting involved in cleaning these marine habitats. I didn't go toward the ocean with a artificial reef system and
I was about
even
about
oyster reefs, right? Mm-hmm. We no longer have a reef system. The reef is the kidney of the ocean. Mm-hmm. And it's the beginning of life. And one of the things we already set into motion is artificial reefs. Mm-hmm. And one oyster that's mm-hmm. submerged cleans 11 gallons of water a day. Mm-hmm. So when we start talking about aquaculture, building an oyster, making larger the oyster beds and creating that, we're also talking about cleaning those waterways. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that can be done, and it sounds like y'all have already gotten started.
Well, we didn't do much with it at that time, so I think maybe this could be a great way to kick off, and I'd love to send it to you, and maybe you can say, here's some things you think could be implemented and so forth. I'll just mention, you just kind of jumped ahead on the exact same thing I was going to say, and that is, you mentioned about the Living Shoreline, and I was going to mention about, because I'm real involved with the Nicholas School of the Environment, and we had a meeting last year here in Charleston where they talked about the importance of living reefs and can we do more to grow living reefs? Can we incorporate something that we're doing? You're talking about artificial, so I guess that's already happening?
It is, and we're going to place a high priority on that.
Wonderful.
And we have companies that have volunteered time and money. Mm-hmm. And we have equity in the bank because their sponsorship simply meant this last time. They did help bring some boats, but we didn't ask people for financial because I felt like they came out and they saw what we're doing. We demonstrated through our actions. Yes, we have some, and we're going to be doing a artificial reef. We've been a little bit slow in the last few months because of COVID,
right,
including on SC7 where we had to limit people. But we are going to be back in the water with artificial reefs as soon as we can. We'd love to work with you.
And even though everything you said was great, I'll just conclude with one last thing, and that is you mentioned about corporations and people being able to, you know, not everything has to be at the expense of somebody. And a good example is my own company, it's not my company, but the one I work for, Raymond James, has a program called Raymond James Cares. And within the firm, they promote anybody who's doing something in their community to really make a difference, and they want them to take pictures and put out, and they promote. And it's just all for goodwill. It's not about money. But the reality is we all know that it pays many, many dividends. And so things like getting corporations locally to be willing and businesses to be willing to participate in these things would be a great way. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am. Let me just, Mr. Mayor, say this. People have heard folks, academics, advocates, government officials talk for a long time. People are tired of talk.
Right.
Like, we need to do something. And as I look back over my life, I realize what an abject failure I've been. Because in spite of my best efforts, we have not moved the needle on this. And it's time to do something. So I think how we measure what we do needs to be by the progress we're making in the environment, not by the number of meetings we have.
Mr. Milliken, I thought I knew who you were, but during that brief time where I was looking rude and pressing my keyboard, I was checking you out.
Yes, sir.
And your stature is much greater than that I had even known. I so appreciate you being here with us.
Delighted to be here.
I agree with you as far as action, and we have to act. You had mentioned your five things that I think we as a group will do that. I think we have to credit our mayor, and this committee didn't exist before. So we know of its importance. You mentioned that the water is coming. Well, it's here.
Yes, sir.
It's here.
Welcome.
Yeah, the next agenda item deals with that, actually. So I think we have two issues. One is the immediate, and the second is the ongoing.
Yes,
and the
sir.
Things that you mentioned, you know, cleaning the waterways is not a one-time thing. Cleaning the waterways is forever.
Yes, sir.
And all of those things. So I trust that this group will come up with actionable items. I happen to be the chair of the Finance Committee. COVID hurt all governments from a revenue standpoint. But at the end of the day, we all prioritize. That's what you do. It's what you do at home. That's what you do here. And honestly, I don't know what is more important than this, because not acting is an action.
Yes, sir. I agree.
And it's a devastating action, quite frankly. So, and I don't think we need a $500,000 consultant to come in to tell us what to do. Mm-hmm. I think we need some steps. We have someone who I heard say is willing to help us, you know, and who better? So I think just moving along to knowing what we're going to do, prioritizing the budget, and move forward, I think we can take action, but we got to do something. We've got to do something. So thank you for
yes,
your
sir.
Time.
Thank you.
One of the questions you asked was about our geography. And so I was looking this up. Out of 52.6 square miles, 45 square miles of Mount Pleasant is land, and 7.5 or 14.3% is water. There are people in the room who may know our linear waterfront distance. I did not know. Does anybody know that figure? You know, if you start up here and you come all the way around, it's a lot. It would be interesting to know.
Yeah.
But one of the things we were talking about in preparation for this meeting is, because I told him, and what we'll get to in this next agenda item, is what do we do for a place and for homeowners, not on the basin level, but on the street level or even block level of a street where the water has no place to go and it's not going anywhere and we can't pump it because then we're pumping it into somebody else's. And that is the biggest frustration. So if we have an idea of where the water is supposed to be going, and it will go there on its own. That's one of the things the Dutch dialogue said, right? It's going to come and it's going to go. And it's how you respond in the interim that decides whether you're, I hate to say winning or losing, but whether you're coping or not, I guess.
Yes.
And so we need to get a look at that. That's one of the things. Where are all our natural outflows? Where are the natural outfalls where water needs to go? And we have done things. I told him that we've done for at least part of the town, the impervious surface rules, which, by the way, the part of town that had its own, for its own district, the old village, its own impervious limits, also has the highest dollar per square foot value of real estate in the town. So also had the most restrictive tree ordinance or regulations for that area. And we have increased our buffers and our trees protection and a few other things. So we're trying to get there in steps. But
it's exciting.
Yeah, and so we're trying to look at the strategic and the tactical, and that's kind of what our agenda is doing today, from the strategic to the tactical. And I was really interested to find out about the solar. My mother-in-law lives in West Point, Georgia, and I like to go what I call the southern route. You go up, you go to Savannah, go up 16, and between Warner Robins and Columbus, Georgia, sometimes from horizon to horizon is a solar farm. So on the one hand, I'm thinking, okay, that's pretty cool. It's not emitting, you know, gases. But on the other hand, you've got a denuded landscape. There's no trees.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of a paradox.
That's a great point, and I think that where people are going, particularly those that have a sort of longer view, is a dual purpose. You know, and I tell people all the time, before you get too intoxicated with this, just think about how those whale advocates felt when they first drilled that first barrel of oil in Pennsylvania. Everybody thought, though, you know, we had finally solved the problem. And so I think that we got to be forward-leaning on all these issues and anticipate. And I think there are ways to create more protective dual usage. It can't all be driven on that just by people who have a pecuniary interest.
If we dig into that report and the follow-up, will we find some things like there? I think the town of Nichols is the one that every structure in there got flooded in, which one? Joaquin? One of those.
Joaquin,
or Florence? Or
and every storm since.
Yeah, every storm since. Every built environment there, every built structure had some.
Yes, sir.
What, and we don't have to go into this now, we'll get on to Hillary's section, but is there advice for those communities on what to do when the water is continually flooding?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
There is, and I'd be happy to come back or get on Zoom calls or whatever and offer whatever little bit I may be able to add to that conversation.
That would be fantastic.
They have a very distinct issue there where they're in the confluence of the Little PD and the Lumber River.
Wow.
And so there is a very unique challenge.
Okay. Anything else before we move on? Tom, thank you very much.
Yes, Mayor.
And if you'll hang around for a little, I don't know if you got to get on the road, but there might be some conversation after the meeting. We won't go too long. If
okay,
you
very
hang
good.
Around
yes,
for
sir.
A little bit. The next item on the agenda, item number 5, is review of flooding incident statistics around town, specifically on frequent trouble spots not included in the proposed Old Village parts targeted for improvements.
If I sit and drive from over here, I'm not sure where the parts are over there, if you don't mind. Thank you for the opportunity. A little bit of good news, and thank you for all of Council's support through your stormwater program already. We have installed oyster reefs at Waterfront Park, Alhambra Hall, and the Pitt Street Bridge. We do that with our Moultrie Middle School and our DNR and other partners. So we're working on some of those items. We're on the Living Shorelines committee with the state working on that problem as well and that solution. So we're also working with the Corps of Engineers on some maintenance permits.
Right.
So there are a lot of things going on, and your stormwater program also offers stream and marshfront cleanups. So you've got a really great foundation for some of those things that we covered today. So I was asked to go through some of the statistics and items around town. So I'm just gonna touch on briefly, just to recall the types of flooding, some of our records and statistics, go through a couple of maps and some photograph examples just to show you what we've had recently, talk about our current mapping and modeling data, and then where we're working in the future and what that looks like. So as we've talked about before, rainfall, tide, and storm surge, and sometimes we get them all at one time. We have different parts of town that have different ages of systems, so their performance where they have storm drain systems, they tend to function very differently. We have different soils and different parts of town. Really, even though we're one community, we do respond to rainfall differently. Sometimes we have issues with debris or structural failure. Our pipes collapse, we have erosion in ditches, and those types of things can impact how the system performs. We have areas of town that don't have infrastructure. I think we've seen that in the Old Village and Old Mount Pleasant. And then sometimes we have changes in use or in flow. We're moving water to perhaps a different basin or watershed, or we're using the property differently, and how we impact that, how that changes over time and how we manage that. We get our records from a couple of different places. We have citizen reports. So if citizens call us and report flooding, we track that information. But I will tell you, not everybody calls us and tells us that they're flooding. A lot of people don't want us to know that they're flooding, which sounds a little odd, but they don't necessarily want a record. Our town records are public records. The FEMA records and flood insurance records are highly confidential, and those are protected information, but things that they call us and tell us, we do track. So we've got a couple different data sets that we've been working on, and I'll go through some of that information. We have staff that responds to rain events, and they will call us and let us know where there are problem areas during the large events as they go out at night or during the hurricanes. And then we've got maps and models that help us make decisions. So these are the statistics coming out of our data sets. The section on the left is the all flooding reports. So we have three prior data sets that I pulled together in this, actually going back to 1994. This is what our stormwater program was built off of, and all of our original stormwater improvement projects, we had 19 targeted ones. We've got one left. And so those are the flood reports from citizens and all of those events from 1994 until halfway through 2015, and that represents 1,400 calls. Of those calls, about 68 of them were reporting house flooding. We had 290 of them reporting yards and then about 400 or streets, and there were some other just nuisance calls are the rest of them. The second column, the 2015 to 2020, that's half of 2015. We started our new database just a few weeks before we started getting hit with the October rainfall.
The thousand year event.
We had just started a new database. We started really flooding in August and continued flooding probably till about 2018.
Wow.
And then 2020 is through August of this year. So you'll see the increase of volume of calls. Our town has grown, but we are also seeing changes in rainfall patterns as well. The second set of numbers are in our new database, the number of calls coming in year by year. So you'll see 2015 is 6 months so of data, and the same thing for 2020, that those bookends are only really half a year, and yet the volume of calls has been pretty intensive. Those are not all structural flooding. That's citizens calling to report nuisance flooding, road flooding, and yard flooding. So we're working to break that data down a little bit better. So where does this happen? So going back to the earlier data set, this pie chart represents where those calls are coming in. We do track them by subdivision and area. The big orange part is the Old Village. So the number of calls that come in from that part of town in that period is a lot larger, followed up by the Groves, Bay Tree, Hobcaw, Snee Farm Gardens, Cooper Estates.
Hobcaw, we're talking Old Hobcaw,
Hobcaw Point, right. Yes, sir. Hidden Cove, Wackendaw, Cooper's Landing, Dunes West, and Harbor Gate Shore. So our older neighborhoods for the most part, that line continues down. And then our newer data set, the same thing, the large pie is again the Old Village, as the largest volume of citizen reports or reports coming in from staff during events, now followed by Long Point, Carolina Park, Charleston National, Hidden Cove, Remley's Point, Brickyard, Cooper Estates. And that's because we're looking at different types of events. So starting in 2015 with these epic floods, we're having a different type of flooding. We're having tidal flooding and larger events, and that they're also seeing and reporting water on the road in those places, or we may have exceeded the design storm for those locations. So it's not necessarily house flooding, but again, the reports of flooding. So what does that look like from a map basis? As you can see, the calls come in from all over town. The majority is kind of clustered towards that Old Village area and in a lot of our older neighborhoods with less infrastructure. You may drive through the Groves today and not see a single storm drain. When they were originally built, they had roadside swales and ditches, and they've just been gone, filled in over the years, and so you'll see less infrastructure in different types of flooding. So what does that look like? We get more photographs now than we used to in the past. So this is the October event. This is up in Darrell Creek, Commonwealth area. So thinking about isolated neighborhoods cut off by floodwaters, and then a lower picture from part of the Old Village area. This is a few weeks later. We were definitely very saturated. We had a tidal flooding event. So this is down at Middle Street and down in Hickory Shadows, Rosemead near Shem Creek. And so that was a tidal event with some rainfall on top. And when we have high tides and it rains, the rainwater can't get out until the tides go down. So we see some different impacts.
Hillary, is there a tidal level at which, granted, the variable is the rain that's on top of that.
Right.
Is there a tidal level at which really gets yours and Jody's attention that we know there's
a potential? So we start seeing, and it's become more frequent, I think as it's reported, and we can certainly get you those graphs and charts, around the 7-foot tide level, we start to see it coming out of the storm drains in the low-lying areas. And we have actually a list,
a map of those
areas. About 7.6 Long Point Road Causeway goes underwater. And so we start to see then water really coming up and impacting our roads. The major roadways, I think Long Point is our most vulnerable, but mm-hmm. for your neighborhood or coming in and out of those areas, and we have those mapped and that list, we keep that for emergency operations that we know where those are. The good thing is most of them have a way around, but those impacts for the other neighborhoods, even if your homes are built up high, this is Long Point, underwater by Snee Farm. And this is in one of our neighborhoods, Harbor Watch subdivisions coming out of the marsh. They've got an elevated home, so their property is protected, but getting cut off from because of the waters. This is Hurricane Irma. Again, this is down on Mill Street, Hadrill Street, and in the Old Village area. We were close to a 9-foot tide on that occasion. This is near Home Farm neighborhood and a subdivision down there. So as we see new development, the houses are elevated, but the roads and things on the ground are not as protected. So April, we had a really large event this past April. And so these are some photographs from some homes around the Old Village. We estimate about 50 homes had flood water in them or underneath them impacting their utilities. We would get calls. One call would say there's 10 homes in my neighborhood flooded, but they wouldn't give us addresses. So we're kind of tracking those that information somewhat loosely. Remley's Point area, and parts of the Old Village. So we had some tidal impacts, but really the amount of rainfall coming down that we're seeing water between neighborhoods and between backyards and flooding out road areas. So chasing sort of the money for some of these flood impacts, we do know where we have FEMA repetitive loss homes, so where they've had flood claims, more than two flood claims over a certain dollar amount. We're not allowed to tell the exact locations, but this is kind of a heat map of where they're located around town. So when you go after federal funds, these are the properties that the federal government wants to see us take care of the flooding problems, and that's where they're willing to target the grant funding, but they have some high standards to try and remove the house or fix the problem. So you can see they're kind of scattered around town. And that number increases. We're at 49 right now, and if we get up to 50, we have to start developing a program to address these areas specifically. So we'll wrap those into those programs. Flood mapping, we usually do more detailed modeling of flood mapping associated with our projects. So you have the Snee Farm project, and may not look great before and after, but we have less water touching the homes after the project. On the right is the Hobcaw Point project, which we've applied for FEMA funding for that project. So kind of a before and after.
How much is that?
We are at, was it 1.3 for Hobcaw? So these are taking care of the worst problems, mm-hmm. upgrading and improving some of the infrastructure in those areas.
As you know, they have a very active neighborhood association. I don't think they have a POA, but
they don't.
But they have an association, and they on their own. You might have been the one who gave it to me. They all got folks to sign that if you know drainage and underground power lines and all that, they're all like, yes, yeah. Cross
so
my property.
So these are the worst things that we can apply for. We have to show a cost benefit for the federal funds.
Okay.
We use tools, so some of the NOAA storm surge mapping tools, so we can look at the town under different storm surges. We've got our new FEMA flood maps. Their 2016 maps hopefully will be finalized and adopted this coming winter, finally. So those tell us where, these are all based on storm surge. None of these maps are based on rainfall flooding, and that's one of the shortcomings that we have. We've been working with partners. This was a project we did with the College of Charleston and NOAA and Sea Grant and Charleston Resiliency Network, working on modeling some of these rain events with different tidal surges, and that data is still forthcoming, unfortunately, because it was through a special grant. We've got three programs where we monitor and pull our flood data into. The town is a part of the Charleston Regional Hazard Mitigation Plan. Every year we submit a status report, an action plan, and our drainage project lists. This helps us qualify for FEMA funding. Those projects need to be nestled up in that plan. We are a FEMA CRS program, so the community rating system is for flood insurance. We have to have those repetitive loss homes, and we have programs for our drainage canal inspections and maintenance for the main trunk systems and our mapping of our drainage systems in order to get flood credits for people that have flood insurance and prove our that we're working on flood resiliency. And then our capital improvement plan has two projects nestled in there, the stormwater infrastructure studies and the drainage canal restoration project to try and dig out some of those old canals that have silted in. The stormwater studies, we list neighborhoods by a kind of a point and ranking criteria, and we really focused on neighborhoods built before in the 1980s. So we had lesser design standards then, and they get credits for repetitive loss and different information as to how they're ranked. And this is where they appear around town. And we are looking out to areas that we connect to that may not be in the town, but we may annex or we may have shared drainage with them that come through different parts of our larger community. So we're looking at those in the future to make sure that as we grow and work with our partners, that those projects can be kind of interconnected. And so that list is maintained in the department and we reevaluate it every year. Our flood study, so the FEMA contracting for that is complete. The scope is developed. We're working with procurement to get that to our on-call engineering firms. The goal is to do both a rainfall flood analysis and tie in some sea level rise change and look at how water moves across our land. We're not down to the specific pipes and outfalls, although we have that information. That gets really expensive. So we want to target the risk areas from this, and then we'll kind of micro project target those smaller areas. We're going to tie it to our design. So looking at different design storms and a couple of those rain bombs, how does our land react to those rain, and then tie in some sea level rise impacts. What happens if the sea level rise is higher and our water cannot get out as quickly? How does that change on the land? So we want to know that. And that will help us prioritize those future study areas and really maybe not go neighborhood by neighborhood, but problem by problem around town and really focus on those issues. So
a quick question on that, and I don't know if Mr. Ullum is in the room or somebody from planning. Are we there you are.
Yeah, Kevin, you got Rob.
As we look at other communities that are doing this, are we seeing flood risk specific areas of towns being treated differently with design, zoning,
yes,
buffer standards? And is that becoming the law?
Is that
legal?
Is that
what's being done?
You're seeing it in Charleston, and we see it in larger communities as well. So they become special areas. We do that for water quality as well. If we've got extra regulations, how are we looking at the new development? And then the challenge becomes the redevelopment. So other older areas of town, can you bring them up to a higher standard? Is it possible with the infrastructure that you have in place? So trying to find that benefit. Really keeping the water out of the structures becomes the goal at that point in time of the project.
At what point in these studies, and again, you heard Mr. Mulliken talking about that when they went from the strategic to the tactical during the 1,000-year flood event.
Right.
At what point will we have the data from these studies and these things to say, here are the areas of this town to minimize this kind of flooding that we have to do something from a regulatory standpoint? I'll give you an example. Just looking at this, and this is a raw impression of just looking at what you have. In one of the areas of town that we have the most persistent flooding and caused, not the old village, but old Mount Pleasant, is also where you're getting the most purchase, tear down, and rebuilding. Where there was a 1,000-square-foot house, there's now a 3,500-square-foot house. And we know about the I believe all of that area is covered by our impervious 40% rule, right, all the way to Coleman, I believe. However, and we've had this conversation before, when it comes to the stormwater fees that we charge, everybody pays the same thing. So somebody with Ayers property with a 900 square foot house pays the same thing as the person with a $2.5 million 7,500 square foot home or something along that line, regardless of how much you contribute to the problem. And this is an area, you know, I don't know what's legal when it comes to stormwater fees about prorating based on impervious surface, but it seems like the logical
it can be done. It is being done in different communities. Some communities have tiers for mm-hmm. residential properties. So depending on the size, you go into a tier. So you could have a smaller tier and then larger homes to different tiers. Other ones go back to a direct impervious measurement. That does require a lot of management right. of staff time. And then you see people going back and saying, okay, well, if you have impervious, a pervious driveway today, do you have it the next time your fee is due? Right. And are you back checking that all of those things are not just being in place, but also being maintained? So are right. they maintaining their functionality as well? So they do require some additional and different resources to manage those types of fee and credit systems, but they are being done in different areas, even here in the Charleston region.
We can get down in the weeds in this at some point, but I think, you know, a way to get from here to there is look at the tiered system to where if you're more of a contributor to runoff and you have more impervious surface by tier as opposed to everybody, no, I put in a pervious driveway last year. Oh, okay, you know, might be a way to solve this problem without charging everybody equally, including those who have not contributed to
We've
the problem.
We've got really good data now where it's easier to do it from a desktop, and then you have to go out and qualify it in the field and verify, but there are ways to go through that data and have that information pulled up. And then if you have new homes built, how do you add those into the billing system as well becomes part of the one of the things we'd have to look at, but yes.
Okay. Committee, y'all have any other? And I'll come back to the question I always come back to that is so frustrating. When you've cleaned the ditches and you've planted the trees and you fixed the basins and we still have streets where we're going to get flooding and people are going to be putting sandbags, what is the end solution for places like, where is that water going to go? And is there anything out there new? Is it underground storage? I know that's thrown around as, oh, it's a whole new, it's the panacea for all of this. No.
I think as we talked about, we got rid of paper bags. We got plastic bags to save the trees for paper bags, and now we're back to paper bags.
Right.
We are conscientious of some of those new technologies, long-term costs of maintenance. What happens if they fail? Are they creating new mosquito breeding grounds and trying to do that? But we're working with our university and college partners to try and make sure we catch those things early. And some of it is living with water. That we are a wet area. It's my curly hair sometimes will tell you that water is a part of it. We expect to see higher tides and more intensive rainfall.
Right.
And so what does that look like? Does the water go away and is it in your house? Or can you get to and from your community? We have places where the houses are safe, but they can't drive because the roads are underwater until the tide goes out.
Is there a scenario down the road where municipalities who have no other option, no other funding, are going to have to look at purchasing some private property to create places to store water?
That does occur, and FEMA will give you some, but it's a cost benefit, and our property values kind of discount us from that program. But that does occur. Greenville has a program where they're self-funding the purchase of those homes.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's kind of like a last resort, I know, but still, yeah.
And this may be off the wall, and there's a lot of people in the room, so I should probably not ask off the wall questions. But in thinking about the Dutch Dialogues and all the great information that was in that, as well as what we've heard today, and having visited Amsterdam, is it even possible to envision a place in Mount Pleasant where we could create a man-made canal that would actually be seen as a positive? That we could actually have things that overlook it that are like excited to be there and yet have it also be a place that stores a lot of water.
Some windmills too. There are a lot of operations in the Netherlands that also support those canals because you're still trying to lift water and move it out to a place. And subsidence is definitely an issue. But we have canals here. We mm-hmm. use them. We have large ditch canal systems. But even those, when we have a high tide, can backflood with the high tide. And sometimes it's a matter of patience. But we work to keep those clean as much as we can, but we're kind of stuck with the marsh and the core for right now and try not to pay for mitigation and trying to keep the money in the maintenance and operations of it. But we do have them, and some neighborhoods have them as a beautification. It's part of their mm-hmm. pond, but we'd need a lot of other operations to make sure we can get the water out once it's over. So.
Thank you very much. I would like the letter that we received from Mike and Carrie Kim at 673 Atlantic to be part of the minutes for today. And I think their pictures were in the pictures that you showed.
Yes, sir.
And thank you very much. But that's just one resident's story of what it's like to be dealing with this. And that's just one. And we know that there are others. One other takeaway, the map that shows where the flooding is just shows that this is more than just an Old Village or Old Mount Pleasant issue, and we've got to address this across the whole community. Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate all you do. Anything else? If there's nothing else, that concludes our agenda. We stand adjourned.